Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Charles Pryor, and you're listening to New Books in British Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. What have the Romans ever done for us? That's the question put to his pals by Reg in a much-quoted scene from Monty Python's Life of Brian. The debate there is notionally about imperial oppression of Judea, but the assembled radicals ultimately agree that, in fact, the Romans were the bringers of sanitation, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a freshwater system, and public health. In other words, they got things done. In his new book, Michael Braddock explores the Romans and the peoples who succeeded them on Britain from the vantage point of the politics of getting things done. It is a concise but wide-ranging book which localizes global history by focusing on agency, the power to do things. In a historical field dominated by attention to power, rulers, and parliaments, this book insists on a shift in perspective and makes a convincing case for history as a resource for meeting the future rather than as a source of comfort and national groupthink. Mike Braddock is professor of history at the University of Sheffield. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Charles.
So you've been on before. We talked about your book about John Lilburn. Before that, God's Fury, England's Fire, a large narrative and incisive history of the Civil War period. So you're a well-known and widely read historian of the Civil War of the 17th century. So what led you to write this book and this kind of book?
Well, it was a kind of a response to Brexit. It's not a book arguing about the outcome of the referendum or whether Brexit was the right thing or not. But I felt very strongly that the Brexit debate was too much about identity and too little about practical politics. Were we better off in or out of the EU? And there are practical arguments on both sides. But I thought much of the debate was really about identity. And as a historian, I found the way that history was used to prop up these positions on identity politics was really unhelpful, and that we could have had a more historically informed argument about how to achieve collective goals and at what level we need to act in order to achieve different kinds of things and act in different kinds of collectivities and so on. And I just thought that the history of collective action on the island of Britain offered more resources for thinking about the EU debate than the history of British identity and the history of the UK. So it's not a Brexit intervention in the sense of saying, I told you so, or we got it all wrong, or, you know, it was the right decision for Britain. But it is a Brexit book in the sense that I think we could have more helpful conversations about collective challenges if we didn't reduce them to matters of identity and if we didn't see the past as simply a source of collective identity.
So it's a Brexit book and I guess a lockdown book as well, presumably written during lockdown.
Yes, yeah, I did. That's right. I've got another project. I don't know if this is quite what you're asking, but there's another project which I couldn't do under lockdown conditions, yeah. And I decided to use my time for this instead. Yeah,
time well used. So the book turns on a central tension between what you describe as collective and differential power. And can you tell us a little bit more about these concepts and how they function in British history?
Yeah, so in the book, I introduce them with a kind of thought experiment that there's a village that needs to drain a marsh, and that's not going to happen through market forces or individual effort. It'll only happen through collective organized action. And so people act together to drain the marsh. By acting together, they exercise a collective power. But someone has to organize that effort and make people work on a Sunday and then decide who gets which bit of the drained land and so on. And so there are people in coordinating positions who have a differential power, that is, power over others. And I think most of politics is like that. It's solving problems that won't be solved by individuals or by the market. It's doing it through exercise of collective power, that by acting together we can do things that the market or individuals can't do. But also when we do that, we create differential power for the people organizing and coordinating the effort. And I then apply that sort of idea, you know, the EU has a differential power to do things that individual states can't do, but then we worry about the differential power of EU bureaucrats, or monarchs have the power to organize national defense, but we worry about their power over our lives or property. And so the relationship between collective power and differential power is regulated through institutions. And so the book is centrally about the variety of ways in which collective institutions have been formed to achieve things together while restricting the differential power of the people who run them. And you know, I then suggest, and I hope there's some plausibility in this, that you can look at a lot of areas of collective life through that lens, and it reveals a lot of areas of political activity that a standard story of the development of Britain and British identity in the UK doesn't reveal. So I think it brings into view more varieties of political action and gives us more resources to think about how to act now and in the future.
So we'll just pick up on the concept of collective institutions. I mean, the prominent ones are those that sort of appear on Prime Minister's Question Time and other forms of light entertainment. But what are the examples that you focus on? There's a lot of them in this book, but I mean, you can pick out some examples, and you know, how are they used? You know, how are they used as mechanisms, I suppose, to achieve these goals?
So one case I speak about at length is the Metropolitan Board of Works in London in the 19th century, where there was a major escalating environmental problem caused by the congregation of people and the difficulty of managing human waste and clean water. And London had grown very quickly, so that there was this large population with a shared problem, but there was no institution that catered for the problem at that scale. The drainage and sewerage were handled by many small bodies in London, and to coordinate a response for the whole of London required some new form of institution. And so I talk about the pressures that led to the creation of the Metropolitan Board of Works, which had responsibility for the whole of London and eventually was able to construct the sewer system, which still mainly serves London. But also the tensions there were over creating a body with that kind of power. So I use that as an example of how a collective problem emerges at a scale where there isn't a collective institution. That institution is eventually created and does meet the challenge. But that, you know, at the same time, there's concern about the differential power of the people running it, because the Metropolitan Board of Works had powers of compulsory purchase and all that in order to construct the cement, the sewers. So I talk about the Metropolitan Board of Works in detail, but across time, these things are, you know, you can talk about Anglo-Saxon kingdoms this way, or you can talk about Kirk sessions in Scotland in the post-Reformation period in this way, quarter sessions in England. It's a way of understanding a lot of what's going on. And I also talk about the arrival of the of Regius Romans, that people are attracted, people on Britain are attracted to cooperation with the Romans because of access to the benefits of the collective institutions. But they're also paying a price in submission to the differential power of the Romans. And that is kind of Regius' issue, isn't it? The you submit to Roman tyranny and you get in return better roads, better sewerage, and all that. So I do elaborate the argument in lots of different directions, but really to illustrate that it's a flexible way of thinking about lots of different kinds of politics and in lots of different kinds of periods. And just one further point is that I start with Stonehenge because from then on, we have quite good evidence for collective organisation on the island. So I've kind of maximised the period of study, all the varieties of collective action over the last 6,000 years, and tried to suggest that this collective differential and the institutionalisation of the relationship helps to think about lots of ways people have got things done.
Mm. So, I mean, when people think of British history or Britain, and I'm here now speaking to our North American and global audiences, British history comes across through some fairly prominent institutions, and it's represented in an endless stream of TV documentaries about the Tudors. It's really a narrative of rulers, kings, queens, legislatures, sovereignty, and as you've mentioned, national identity, which really came to the fore in Brexit and elsewhere in that year. But in this book, you show how power functioned and was deployed on varying scales. And I can see a sort of a return to some of your earlier work on the state here. So what does this more localized perspective reveal to us? What do these varying scales of political action reveal?
Well, I think it people often say that the past is a foreign country, and that, you know, and that's the value of history. But I think as a historian, you can see the present as a foreign country. You can see things that are taken for granted in the present, which aren't necessarily natural or eternal or enduring. And so in order to shock, I say on the back of the book that the United Kingdom hasn't yet lasted as long as the Kingdom of Wessex, and it may not do so. And so to think that the natural centre of political life on the island are the institutions at Westminster and the collective identity associated with them is to take for granted something which shouldn't be taken for granted. I say that because I believe in the Union, and I want us to take the Union seriously and do what's necessary to preserve it. But, you know, an opponent of the Union could equally say, well, there we are, you know, why stick with the Union? But the idea is that by looking at the variety of scales of action on the island, it renders the present it historicizes the present. It makes the present look like it might change and it could change, and that we should try to make it change in the right ways and not the wrong ways. So it's in that way, I think, that an awareness of the oddity of the present is potentially useful, because it helps us identify what we might want to do in order to preserve what's good about how we do things and change what's not good about how we do things, and not see them as sort of natural or inevitable products of the way life is on the island.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm just listening to that and reading the book, and I sort of hit it in my intro a bit. You customarily, I'm going off piste a little bit, but so just let's run with it. But you say on Britain, not in it.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, so I try to, if you take my view that Britain is not a natural political community, why write a history of Britain? Well, it's a geographical area, and usually right. You say of an island, it's on the island. So it's the history of how people have organised on the island. Mm-hmm. If you say in Britain, you're sort of assuming that Britain is a unified community, which in the 9th century makes no sense. In the Roman period makes no sense. The Romans didn't conquer the whole island. So I try. It's a bit artful, I know, but it's. if you think about how, I'm trying to get us to think about the island as a geographical space on which people have organised themselves quite differently at different times, and another thing I say in the book is that not many islands are unified states. Actually, of the top 10, if Greenland's the biggest of the top 10, only Madagascar is a unitary state, because of course Britain isn't. It's it's the island of Great Britain plus a bit of the neighboring island, and most islands are like that. They're part they're part of a political entity that overlaps the island but isn't restricted solely to the island. And again, that's true of most of British history. The Romans connected the south of the island with continental Europe. The Vikings connected the Shetland, connected Orkney with the Nordic world into the 15th century. So the island, if you think about overlays of political institutions, they very rarely map onto the island. So what I want to think about is people living on the island of Britain interacting with institutions with very different geographies.
And of course, that scaled up globally, if you think imperially in the West and East. I mean, this small island projecting tremendous political control, but Apache political control all over the place, really.
Absolutely. I mean, the United Kingdom is formed at a moment when the English crown's exercising authority in North America, West Africa, and South Asia. And there's not really a moment where the island is united but not governing some other part of the globe. So you know, thinking of Britain as a natural political unit is a really odd thing to do.
So your concluding argument, and I think it's probably a mischaracterization to call it a concluding argument in many ways, is the red thread of the book, is a case for political agency over the centrality of institutions and identity. And that, as you've been saying, entails a pivot away from a whole set of comforting national coordinates. John Major, the sun going across the cricket pitch or something.
That's right. The old maids cycling home to tea past sun-drenched cricket grounds. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Downton Abbey. People love that stuff. but those things are sort of comforting, but also thinking about it, kind of polarizing too. Identity, culture, citizenship, nostalgia for a neatly constructed past. So, why is that pivot necessary right now? I guess here we come back to Brexit and I guess the position of Britain globally.
Yeah, I think it's that many of the challenges we face globally, we're speaking as COP26 is or is not working. Many of our challenges are much larger than the island. COVID is an issue much larger than the island. We need to act collectively and politically beyond the island, and Brexit has ruled out doing that through the EU, but it hasn't answered how we are going to do it. And I don't think a retreat to that kind of nativism is a viable political strategy. Even if our vaccination program has been very successful, we're not safe until everyone in the globe is vaccinated and public health problems globally have been addressed. You know, so I think it's partly about the scale of political challenges and how we are going to address them if it's not through the EU. But it's also this way of thinking about institutions is it raises questions about who gets to make them work and how effectively they serve the collectivity, and whether the power of the people dominating those institutions is distorting their collective value. So in that sense, it's also a way of talking about political inclusion and who is in the collective and how is their voice heard, and are they able to shape the use of collective institutions. And I think that speaks to another set of issues in Britain about social inclusion, political inclusion, but also the value of a vote in a Westminster election and how effectively any of us as citizens really do shape the use of our collective institutions. So I think putting these questions this way raises lots of contemporary political issues and gives access to past experience that might help us think about them. And I think it's a much more useful way of using the past than that kind of cementing a Downton Abbey version of Britishness, which is really upper middle class Englishness, white Englishness, heterosexual Englishness. And so it goes back to my starting point, which is history is a source of identity, of course, but it's also a source of experience. And I think it's more useful to us as a source of past experience. How did clever people in the past confront their collective challenges and regulate these relationships between collective and differential power? That, I think, might give us resources to think about the present and the future.
It is a useful history of Britain, this book, The Politics of Getting Things Done, published by Oxford University Press, written by Michael Braddock, who is professor of history at Sheffield. Thanks, Mike, for taking some time to talk to me about this excellent book. Everybody go out and buy one.
Or two. Thank you very much, Charles.
You're welcome.
It was a great pleasure.
Thank you.